Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we take a look at Arizona's new logo and brand and who it's made for.
And our Last Resort series continues as we learn about one of the original cowboy artists who helped paint a picture of the rest for the rest of the country.
But first, I'm joined in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, as you know, I've been trying to have some conversations with undecided voters recently. And one of the groups I have been most interested to hear from is Nikki Haley supporters. Nikki Haley is, of course, the Republican former governor of South Carolina. She served as UN ambassador under former President Trump. And while the 2024 presidential primary for Republicans seems like ancient history at this point, it is worth remembering that Haley received over 4 million votes from Republican primary voters, including about 110,000 here in Arizona. And that number is notable for a couple reasons. First, because it's much larger than Joe Biden's margin of victory here in 2020. And second, Haley had already dropped out of the race by the time of the Arizona Republican primary, which suggests that her supporters weren't willing to simply throw their support to Donald Trump. So, in what's looking like it's going to be a very close election between Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, Haley supporters could make a big difference. With all of that in mind, I had the chance to sit down yesterday with Amanda Sprowls. She is a self-described small business owner here in Tempe, and she's the co-chair of the Haley Voters Working Group. Now, this is not a formal political action committee or anything. It's a coalition of disaffected Haley voters across multiple states who have spent the last few months trying to get both the Trump and Harris campaigns to adopt positions that reflect Haley's point of view. And they have had a lot of success. One of their members actually spoke at the DNC last month. As Sprowls told me, she feels like Haley voters are in a position to decide this election.
Our votes are really the critical votes in this cycle. And Trump, I mean, he just recently said it within just a few days ago. He said he does not need us. If we didn't support him in the primary, he doesn't need us.
One person who didn't support me, and now that person came back to me. I don't want that person. I don't want that person. You know, they say you should take everybody, but that's not the way I'm built.
I think that we have a big group of Republicans that are basically Republicans in revolt.
And if you're comfortable saying, where are you at this moment? We're talking right now the day before the debate between Vice President Harris and former President Trump. How would you characterize yourself right now? Undecided or?
You know, I will not vote for Trump. Again, I did vote for him in 2016 and I voted for him in 2020. I will not vote for him again. And I think that the message that I try to bring on social media is just that the Trump governing style, the Trump policies, those are not winning policies for Republicans. And we see that over and over again. You know, we saw it. He barely won in 2016, but 2018, we had a loss. 2020, we had a loss. Arizona is a great example of that. We're the canary in the coal mine, and I keep saying that we cannot bring hate and vitriol and crazy policies like high tariffs. I mean, we can't bring those things to the table and assume we're going to win. That being said, at this point, I don't think Harris has earned my vote. At this point, she has definitely made inroads. And through the Haley Voting Working Group, we've met with the campaign. We met with them very early on.
Uh-huh.
We met with them. We were one of the strongest proponents at the time of the Biden-Harris administration shutting down the border because there's just no going forward with any Haley voters, with any Republican votes if they can't do that.
And the meetings that you had, were these with the candidate directly or with representatives from the campaign?
With representatives from the campaign.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And border was top of mind for you at that time.
For me, the issues are obviously the border and then tax policy. Those are the most important things to me.
And I know you were just referencing the fact that former President Trump had said publicly, we don't need you, to Haley voters. Has there been any outreach to the Haley Voters Working Group from the Trump campaign?
No, there has not been.
Gotcha. So I had a conversation recently with some RFK Jr. voters who were reckoning with RFK's decision to drop out and endorse former President Trump. What has been your process and the nature of the conversations you've had with other Haley voters about Haley's endorsement of Trump?
Obviously, some Haley voters were very, very disappointed in that. A lot of Haley voters really did understand. And the reality is that Haley has been the strongest at speaking, trying to explain, let's say, where Trump could make policy changes that would make him more effective and make him more palatable.
I disagree with Trump on tariffs. If you do tariffs across the board, you're raising prices on farmers, on businesses, on consumers. It's never a good idea.
And she just recently did that this weekend again.
Do I agree with his style? Do I agree with his approach? Do I agree with his communications? No. When I look at the policies and how they affect my family and how I think they're going to affect the country, that's where I go back and I look at the differences. I mean, these are the candidates we have been given.
I mean, Haley supporters, we are not a cult of personality. We are the most educated members of the electorate. We are absolutely policy driven and we want to win. And I would just say that the fact that that RFK is in the transition team and is potentially looked at for a cabinet spot is a horror to Haley voters, is a horror. It shows a lack of discipline and decision-making on Trump's part.
Gotcha. If you look ahead to a hypothetical Harris presidency, do you feel like you could get to a place where you could support Harris's presidency, or do you view it as sort of a necessary corrective step towards elevating a different kind of Republican presidential candidate next time around?
So at this point, I think a lot of Haley voters, if they've had to make a decision, and it's for a lot of them, it's just a coin toss. I mean, it's just a leap of faith, whether you're going to do a leap of faith and hope that Trump is just not as crazy as he's been vocalizing and that his policies are not going to be as crazy as he talks about, and that he's talking about tariffs, but he won't really do it. He's talking about giving Ukraine back to Russia, and we're just hoping he wouldn't do that, right? So that's that leap of faith. Then there's a leap of faith on the other side that says that, you know, this move to the center by Harris isn't just talk, that she's going to mean it, and that maybe, let's say, she'll become like, you know, the second term Clinton, and all of a sudden we'll have welfare reform and tax reform and, you know, some fiscal policy reform. But that's a leap of faith as well. But if you're a principled Republican, if you believe, you know, in really true free market and personal responsibility, all these sort of things, then even if you chose to vote for Harris, you're not going to be supportive of a Harris presidency, to be honest with you. I think what you're going to be supportive of is, or what you're potentially reckoning with, is we get a bite at Congress in 2026, and that hopefully we have figured out how to refocus on true Republican policies again and are able to run a really high-quality candidate. I mean, you have Nikki Haley, you have Kemp, you have Youngkin, you've got DeSantis. I mean, you've got a really strong group of people out there. Pompeo, I mean, you've got a lot of them that could run in 28. And I think that's ultimately what all Haley Republicans want to see.
You mentioned the meeting that you had with representatives from the Harris campaign prior to the change to the border policy. Do you feel like you have seen other implicit signals from the campaign that appeals like the ones coming from Haley voters like yourself are getting through?
They have made some good adjustments. It's not as much as obviously we would have wanted, but I think recently, though I would not excited about a 28% capital gains rate. I think that the fact that she has acknowledged that Biden's proposal of a 39% capital gains rate was wrong. I think she's throwing some bones our way. What I would really like to hear her say is that she would support maintaining the 20% qualified business, small business deduction for the S-Corps. That's really important. Most of your small businesses, that is the category that they fall within. If that were to sunset, that could have some pretty traumatic results within the economy because, you know, we're looking at, you know, small businesses are the ones that hire in the country. We're the ones that are leasing the buildings. And, you know, we need to acknowledge that and keep that cluster strong. So I'd really like to hear more from her on tax policy right now and keep that stability of the current tax rates.
Yeah. So do you deal with backlash from fellow Republicans on this?
Yes, I do. We do. Some of our members have, and maybe me being on the radio right now will cause this to happen, but some of our members, I mean, we certainly, they've been, doxed. Some of them, they've gotten death threats, you know, really some pretty horrible stuff, just random things, you know, horrible, somebody's wife, their information got out there and she was getting horrible phone calls. I mean, things like that do happen. But we need to act like grown-ups. If you want to wish that things were different than they are, that's fine. But you really need to look at the political reality and sort of like a business. Let's look at it. The reality of the situation is, and probably a Trump win will be a disaster for Republicans electorally for the next 8 years because it is a poison pill.
All right. Well, Amanda Stewart Sprowls, co-chair of the Haley Voters Working Group, thank you for coming on the radio to talk about this.
Thank you.
And Sam Dingman is still in studio with me. So, Sam, what are your takeaways from that conversation?
Well, I think it's noteworthy that Sprowls says the Harris campaign has been in direct contact with the Haley Voters Working Group. And actually, on the Haley Voters Working Group Twitter account, they claim they have had 3 separate meetings with the Harris team. And according to them, some of the things they have advocated for in those meetings include a bipartisan presidential cabinet, a commitment to continued military support for Israel, and support for fracking. And those are all positions that we have seen Harris take publicly in recent weeks.
I mean, there have been plenty of headlines this week about Harris's so-called pivot to the center. It's particularly interesting given the overall tightening of the head-to-head polls between her and former President Trump.
Yes, I think it's going to be fascinating to see if Harris doubles down on these more centrist policies in the debate tonight, because this conversation with Amanda certainly gave me the sense that Harris is committed to wooing these middle-of-the-road Republican voters.
Well, Sam, what did he make of what Amanda Sprowls said about her long-term vision for the Republican Party?
That was pretty fascinating, I think. She said at one point, we care about winning, but it seems like her version of winning is more of a long-term strategy and that it is worth losing a big-ticket election now in the name of positioning other Republicans to perform well in future cycles. And we heard this, some of the names she cited in our conversation that she would like to see become Republican standard bearers in the future, besides Nikki Haley, include Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and Georgia Governor Brian Kemp.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider whether the Harris campaign is weighing that as they make these overtures to the Haley contingent of the GOP.
Yes, though it certainly seems like there is some indication that they are willing to take that gamble.
Interesting. All right, we'll see how it all plays out tonight in that debate, of course. That was the show's Sam Dingman bringing us a conversation with Amanda Sprowls, co-chair of the Haley Voters Working Group. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Mark.
When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled this summer in a case that struck down the so-called Chevron deference, many observers wondered about the impact on environmental regulations. The doctrine generally held that federal courts had to defer to the way federal agencies interpreted laws that left wiggle room. But the environment isn't the only area which could see some significant changes as a result of this ruling. Jen Pyatt is a research scholar at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and co-director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy. She joins me to talk about the impact of this ruling on health policy. And Jen, how big of a deal might this actually be?
really, really insurmountable. I mean, this could be something that changes just about everything that we look at with respect to health policy, because this is a decision that really, at the bottom of it, affects federal agencies' ability to do their jobs. And a lot of what we have in respect to health policy in the United States comes from federal agencies like HHS, like CMS, like CDC, like FDA. So all of those agencies and all of those rules that they implement could be at issue here.
Is this a matter of, as you say, so much input by federal agencies? Because a lot of the policies that are in place are rules as opposed to laws?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great question. So I would say that most of the law that we have in place in this country that specifically governs everyday health-related activities is regulatory, is coming from those agencies. You know, and that makes sense because Congress, what they do is they pass laws with kind of broad language because that's what the two parties can generally agree to. So when they pass those laws, they leave some wiggle room, and that is where agencies come in to fill in those gaps. So when you're talking about, you know, the specifics of policy that's really impactful, a lot of that is coming from agencies.
So are there particular areas that you are looking at as maybe some of the first to that folks might see impacts in?
So, yes, absolutely. There are tons of them, but I'll point to actually an area where we've already seen impacts. So we've already had a couple of cases, one out of Tennessee and one out of Montana. So these cases deal with the Affordable Care Act. Essentially, the Affordable Care Act prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex in health programs that are federally funded, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. And HHS put out a rule that said, well, that sex-based discrimination, that should apply to discrimination against people who are LGBTQ. And these two court decisions out of Montana and out of Tennessee said, nope, we don't have to defer to that. And actually, HHS, you have overstepped your authority under the ACA in saying that. So we have this real substantial discrimination-based rule in all of the federally funded health programs that's kind of, you know, at issue already and on ice as this litigation continues. And that's just a quick example of something that already happened. But there are tons of other areas where this could be impactful. This could impact, you know, FDA and its drug approval process. This could impact insurance and CMS and the Medicare and Medicaid program. So tons of areas that are just rife for this decision to impact.
It seems like there's a ton of uncertainty coming up, both for patients and for providers and for pretty much everybody involved in the health sector.
Absolutely. And that's the real crux of this, right? Because we don't actually know what individual judges around the country are going to do. And that's what this Loper decision boils down to. It's no longer, let's defer to the experts in the agencies who have that very specific scientific or technical training and experience to tell us what's going on. It's what does this one judge in this one district, in this one state think?
Well, so I guess that's the question then, right? Like, if you are somebody who, for example, believes that LGBTQ people should not be discriminated against in things like Medicare and Medicaid, is that the kind of thing that you should be trying now to codify in law and say specifically, not leave it to the interpretation of a federal agency, but have the law specifically say, nope, this is what we think?
Yeah, that's absolutely one pathway that you could go is you could say, okay, well, let's address these particular issues and get Congress to go ahead and codify that. But when you think about the fact that federal regulatory agencies are putting out new rules on average, like every 2 weeks or so, that's a lot to ask of Congress. We know that Congress just historically and recently isn't getting that much done. Isn't getting as much done as what these federal regulatory agencies are doing to keep abreast, to keep up with the changes and with the state of things. And so, yeah, you could ask Congress to take sort of a piece by piece look at these issues, but that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of political effort.
Do you think that federal agencies are going to scale back their rules and interpretations given this Supreme Court ruling?
I think it's entirely possible that agencies will be a little bit more hesitant to take action.
Well, so what do you think this is going to mean for health policy and healthcare policy coming out of Congress going forward?
You know, I would be interested to learn that myself. I think it's possible that we get a Congress that realizes that, you know, they have to step in here and make things more clear and give a little bit more power very clearly to the agencies on the issues where they want those agencies to step in. I also think it's possible that, given the right makeup of Congress, you could see Congress come in and try to codify what Chevron used to be and say, no, actually what we mean with respect to, you know, administrative agencies is that, yeah, you do give them deference because we're never going to be able to be as specific as those agencies are and get those bills through this process. But whether that will happen is just entirely dependent on who is making up that Congress right, as we head into this election.
Well, so I'm also curious, given the size and the impact of the healthcare sector on the American economy, what might all of this mean financially and economically?
Oh, boy. It's going to be a really interesting time. We don't even really know truly what the extent of the impacts will be because we just don't know everything that might be litigated, everything that might be coming up in the months and years to come. I mean, there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these rules, and there are tons of litigants and private parties and businesses, et cetera, that are willing to try to go and challenge them. And that uncertainty, I think, can impact, you know, the desire to invest and desire to put energy into funding, you know, for example, very expensive testing and clinical trials on prescription drugs, et cetera. If you're not even sure if FDA is going to have that sort of nationwide approval because of a specific statutory interpretation question that now is getting relitigated. So I think, yeah, the economic impacts can be really, really great.
All right. That is Jen Pyatt, co-director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Jen, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a museum and art history expert dives into the intersection of museums and identity politics.
But first, Arizona has a new logo, part of a new branding campaign unveiled by the Arizona Office of Tourism late last month. It features a turquoise Arizona with the Z fading into a jagged mountainscape that's topped by a copper-colored O shaped like the sun. But it's made up of Arizona-themed icons. The firm hired to create the new campaign worked with an indigenous artist to do it, creating what tourism officials said would communicate all that Arizona has to offer. The campaign was paid for with $700,000 worth of pandemic relief money, according to the Arizona Republic. And it took years and 2,000 people at listening sessions across the state. But what does it mean to brand a state? And who is something like this aimed at anyway? To find out, I got a hold of ASU marketing professor John Pierce, who's worked on campaigns like this before and told me why they often begin.
Usually there's a new administration. You have a new person in charge of tourism or business development. And usually there's some new set of truths about the state, you know, changing dynamics that the folks involved feel like it's a priority to kind of reframe how they want other people, namely tourists or business travelers, to think about, you know, their state or city.
So, I mean, what's the goal here when you're talking about branding something that's not a product, right? Like it's a place. How do you approach that differently than you might, you know, say like a piece of clothing or a makeup line or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, brands are created from products, services, and ideas. And if you think about it, Arizona is an idea that the state would like for people who were thinking about visiting, either for leisure travel or for business travel, that when they think about the state of Arizona, either through this representation of the brand mark or through a piece of creative, that whatever they see or hear conjures up an image that the consumer can connect with. So it's the idea that a brand exists to create in the consumer's mind an image, positive or negative, of what that idea is all about.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what do you make of this Vibrant Arizona campaign? It's a new logo. More will be coming, it sounds like, next year. Does this kind of do, in your opinion, what tourism officials here say it's going to do and brand us as something more than golf courses and resorts for everybody out there?
I think they did a terrific job with it, to be honest. I think this is no easy work. I worked on the city of Colorado Springs on the task force that developed the logo for that city. And before we even got started, we had 15 deliverables, you know, things that had to be in the logo. And that was just for a city that's a quarter of the size of Phoenix, let alone the whole state. So I imagine when they sat down, they had a lot of things they felt like they needed to deliver on, and yet at the same time, create a mark, a brand mark, that, you know, communicated what the idea of Arizona is about.
What idea do you think this delivers, I guess? Like, they did bring in an indigenous artist to work with them on this, the firm did, which is an interesting approach, and there is a lot of sort of cultural elements integrated here. How does this come across to you? What's the message?
I think the message is that, you know, there's something for everybody here. If you look at the mandala that they used, which is the design effect to show different symbols, you know, they've included things that represent the northern part of the state. They've included things that represent the southern part of the state, our industry, our people, our terrain, all in a way that creates this idea that you're going to find here what you're looking for versus telling people what they should be finding here.
Who does this kind of branding appeal to? Who is it trying to appeal to? Like, when a place is branding itself in this way, a state or a city or something like that, are we looking outward? Are we looking to tourists, people we want to come here? Some campaigns are very explicitly like that. Or is this more about giving Arizonans an identity?
I don't know this for certain, but I would think that 90% of the audience for this brand mark and the associated kind of creative that goes around it would be leisure travelers from other states in the U.S., other countries around the world, and for business travelers and people who book business conventions. Because that's where people are going to see this. I don't envision them using this brand mark in and around Arizona all that much. So you probably only see it if you were looking for places to visit for personal vacation or for business travel. In addition, I think 10% of it is probably kind of red meat for Arizonans to feel good about themselves. But I think the heavy lifting on this is going to be attracting business and leisure travelers.
Right. And I know of campaigns that came to mind when I was thinking about this, like that I have seen for other places a lot around Phoenix and around Arizona, right? Like, there's a campaign for Albuquerque that was up on a lot of billboards recently. You know, those commercials for California that are full of celebrities, right? There are some that really stand out. What do you think are some good ones? What do they do well?
Well, I think the California, frankly, I know they're a rival state, but I think they do a really good job. They had a campaign previously called Dream Big, which was also kind of, you know, getting at this idea that, you know, if you're a business traveler, you know, you can have big business ideas here. And if you're a leisure traveler, you can do the same. And then they just switched to a tagline called Ultimate Playground, which I think is probably more geared toward leisure travel.
Yeah.
But I think they do a really good job with an equally difficult job expressing the California as an idea versus California as a geography.
People often have like preconceived notions about a place, right? Like, there are a lot of stereotypes out there about Arizona. I mean, this new logo really, you know, uses the sun, but I mean, extreme heat is definitely one of them that's probably difficult for us right now. California, same thing. Like, people already kind of know what they think about that place or whether or not they'd want to go there. Do these kind of campaigns change minds?
I think a campaign like this and the brand mark that they've created around it has the opportunity to change people's perspective and invite them to investigate a little more. Because keeping in mind, this is a brand mark and a campaign. It doesn't change the reality, you know, on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is that I see this, I'm thinking about Arizona. I'm like, oh, I didn't really think about, like, people are surprised there's mountains in Arizona.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they've carefully included that in the brand mark design. People don't think there's fishing here, and there is. So I think it may invite someone who's otherwise not interested to dig a little deeper. It doesn't solve, you know, the opportunity outright, but I think it invites people to dig a little deeper.
Yeah. So I wonder, as you work on a campaign like this, right, like this is using public dollars, like there's got to be a measurement of success that comes with campaigns like these. Like, can you tell, can you link like a new branding campaign with tourism dollars that come in because of it?
I would think that they're going to be able to look year over year in 2 or 3 years to say, the way we communicate about Arizona is working or it's not working. And the mm-hmm. brand mark would be part of that. I think about like the Nike brand mark when they created it, you know, in 1971, they had no idea that mark would still be used in 2024. In fact, Phil Knight, the founder, famously said, I don't love it, but maybe it will grow on me.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there on that good note. That is John Pierce, a marketing professor at ASU, joining us to talk about Arizona's new campaign branding here. John, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for breaking this down with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Visitors from the East Coast or Midwest have headed to the Valley looking for something different, or maybe just some sunshine. We're exploring the history and future of resorts and the Valley as a resort community in a series called Last Resorts. To do that, we're traveling from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park, visiting some of the Valley's oldest and newest resorts, and hearing how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world, come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
And today we visit the Hermosa Inn in PV, specifically a room that looks like a library filled with the paintings of Lon McGarvey. If his name sounds familiar, he's the Lon for whom the resort's restaurant is named. McGarvey's paintings depicted the West, or maybe they depicted an idealized version of the West that would appeal to people in the Midwest or on the East Coast and encourage them to travel here. Either way, his work helped build the Hermosa Inn and the region. I met with Betsy Fallman in the resort's library to talk more about Lon McGarvey, his work, and his legacy. She considers him Arizona's original cowboy artist. Fallman is a professor of art history at ASU and adjunct curator of American art at the Phoenix Art Museum. She's also author of the book The Cowboy's Dream, The Mythic Life and Art of Lon McGarvey. And sitting surrounded by his paintings, I asked Fallman who exactly Lon was.
Lon was an interesting guy. He had multiple identities. He never told the truth if he could help it. He grew up in Philadelphia, but came out here to live finally, and he could change his name. I mean, this is a Western thing. You can go to a new place and you can get another name. So he added a few letters to his name, but he never was related to anyone with that name. And so he came out and he claimed to be a rancher. He didn't own the ranch. He did paintings. He did commercial work at a time when it was very lucrative to do commercial work. But he could make money, but he had a hard time holding on to it.
So let's talk about what drew him out here. I mean, we hear a lot, especially at the time that mm-hmm. he was coming out here, and you alluded to this, you come west, it's sort of a fresh start.
Right.
Was that what drew him out here?
I think Partly. He sometimes did it in the wrong way. He'd come out here in the summers and then go back to Philadelphia to do art school.
Yeah, that's not good.
And then finally came out here, you know, full time. But he also worked at Paramount designing sets. And he always had a line, you know, okay, I could do this in blue, or if you want, I'd like you to buy this. Do you, you know, all that kind of things. He was always on the make, I think. But he did some important commissions. He did the A1 Beer commissions, which are really quite interesting. There are four of them, but the best one is The Cowboy's Dream. And when I worked on this, I got a whole line of people who said, oh, I know the model. And, of course, it was Lon. It wasn't them. And that they, you know, they had been part of that, and they weren't.
What was so alluring about the cowboy lifestyle to him?
I think he found it fascinating. That it was a whole different way of living that he didn't have in Philadelphia. And if you look at the covers for the magazines up there, some of them are Lon posing, but they're, you know, he tried to capture that essence of the American West in his own way. I spent a lot of time, the Adventure magazine up there was, someone claimed it was famous movie star in Hollywood, but it wasn't, and it's actually Lon who was modeling there, and he was the model actually for the first A1 picture. So, but it was just a way of living and a place that you could invent yourself again. It was cheap to live out here. You could kind of get out of the way if you needed to, but he had a very flexible view of life.
Well, it seems like maybe, you know, you hear so much about people drawn to like the rugged lifestyle or the gritty mm-hmm. kind of lifestyle that you can have in the West as a cowboy. It seems like that was maybe less important to Lon than the fact that he could be maybe somewhat anonymous and could, as you've alluded to, you know, not change his identity per se, but sort of become somebody else.
Right, right. I mean, because he never did own the ranch. He did some cowboying, but he was a short guy. If you ever see a picture of him, he's not a tall guy at all. So that wasn't the Western, you know, view that one had. But I think he found it convenient to live out here. He could do what he wanted for a while. He did get good commissions, and he was a very busy painter.
How would you say that his paintings evolved over time? Obviously, he started when he was on the East Coast
right.
and then came out here.
Right.
So I would think that it's not just something you can snap your fingers and become a cowboy artist or Western artist.
No. He did art study. You know, he liked to claim he was born in Tombstone. That wasn't true. There, and he did go to art school. I had the records of that. So he wasn't just sort of doing it on his own. So by the end of his career, he's working in a very expressionist way. That's a rather different style from his early years. And that is his late style. He did some scarves. He, you know, he tried a little bit of everything. And he always had an angle. Oh, you like that? I'll, you know, do these for free, or not for free, but you can buy them from me. But he wasn't a very good salesman in some ways. But Governor Hunt, I think, supported him a lot. And one of the tales is he met Governor Hunt by, Hunt was hitchhiking someplace. And he got picked up by Lon. And they talked, and that's how they met. I mean, and that would seem a very improbable thing today.
Yeah.
But I guess that worked in that time. So,
huh.
But Hunt was a good supporter of him.
So let's talk about the place that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
We're at
mm-hmm.
Lon's at the Hermosa Inn. And this started off in some way as a place that he built or had built for himself?
Yeah, he because, you know, Toby was cheap. I'm sure he worked with someone, because I don't think he probably had the skill set to do the whole thing. But he didn't keep it very long. And it may have been an inn. I'm not quite sure, but I know he did live there. And so he sold it during a divorce because he needed the money for that. But it was I have pictures of it. But it's an interesting commission. But he couldn't keep it very long.
So when you look at this facility mm-hmm. now, how much does it sort of look like if he had the resources maybe to do it?
I think had he had the resources, it would have looked very much like it does now. There are earlier pieces that you can see in the front gate, but the people who've restored this over the years have kept very much to the aesthetic of Lon McGarvey.
It seems like there's a very interesting dynamic at play here, that what drew Lon to the West and to Arizona in many ways is what the travel and tourism industry used in some ways in that same time to
Absolutely.
Draw other people out here, sort of the mystique of the West, the aura of the West, maybe the mystery of the West.
No, that definitely was it, because he stayed. And he had multiple houses. He had a house out in Cave Creek. He had a house in Sedona. His last house was in Sedona. And he had a few other little spots there. So, you know, he was really into what went on for a Western person.
So when you walk around here and you look at his paintings and his prints on the wall and the building, both the original and what has been built in addition, and you think about his career and, you know, sort of what brought him here and how his life went here, what comes to mind for you?
Well, the fact that he stayed and he really identified himself as an Arizona artist, even though he would travel to, you know, the West Coast from time to time and, you know, go to Mexico because there's a couple of paintings of Mexico. But I think it just suited him. I don't think he was kind of a loner. So I don't think he wanted to be in a place like the Taos Squat Society, and that was too big, too many people, too much competition. And so I think it suited him to be out here. He could do very different things.
Let me ask you about Lon's work for Stetson, because that was also seemingly a pretty big part
that
of his career.
That was a very good commission. He did about four or five, maybe up to seven different versions of what Stetson had. It was the last draw from his Stetson that made the name. There, and it wasn't invented by him. There are other earlier artists who had the last drop, you know, seed. And what they did was the cowboy bent down and gave his horse a drink before he had a drink, because you couldn't go anywhere without your horse. You could live without a wife, but not without the horse. So that one was sort of the iconic one. But he did a whole series of them that every so often you see come up.
What do you think Lon's legacy is in terms of not the development of the West and of Arizona, but of maybe teaching people about it or showing people who had never been here or weren't from here what Arizona looked like, and maybe to an extent encouraging them to come visit or come move?
Good question. I don't know that he was that commercial in that way. But certainly the imagery that he did, you know, whether it was a magazine cover or whether it was a painting or whether it was a print, he did a lot of prints and portfolios because they could be sold more cheaply. And I think if it sold, he was really happy to do it, truly. But I think, you know, he really imbued the spirit of what the West was.
Betsy Fallman is a professor of art history at ASU and adjunct curator of American art at the Phoenix Art Museum. She's also author of the book, The Cowboy's Dream, The Mythic Life and Art of Lon McGarghy. We'll post some examples of McGarghy's work at theshow.kjzz.org. And next Tuesday, in our next installment of our Last Resort series, we'll find out how a tire and rubber company helped build the West Valley's tourism industry. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Identity politics is a divisive term today. It's been tied to this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, to critical race theory, culture war issues. But our next guest says it's an idea that started a long time ago in American history. It was first popularized by an organization of queer black feminists in 1977. But from the civil rights movements of the 1960s to abolitionism and women's suffrage 200 years ago, identity politics has been a part of the American psyche for generations. Cecilia Fajardo-Hill teaches museum studies and art history in ASU School of Art, and in her course titled Identity Politics and Exhibition, she dives deep into how identity politics has intersected with museums throughout history. I spoke with her more about it, beginning with the Whitney Biennial in 1993, which went down in history as one of the most political and controversial of all time.
The Whitney Biennial is an exhibition that defines, in a way, every 2 years what American art is at the time. Mm-hmm. And it had always been primarily an exhibition of white artists and prominently men. So for the first time in its whole history, the Whitney Biennial was actually primarily diverse artists. And because it was so contentious, it was very political. There was even a video of the Rodney King beating in LA. So it was really violently criticized as a biennial that was being so political that the art was being left behind. And as a result of that, I mean, it was an important moment in the history. And today we remember it as one of the most important exhibitions of the Whitney Biennial. Now they're much more political. But the following biennial, all the numbers, the women's participation, you know, participation of diversity completely was again flattened out. Because mm-hmm. that's what happens. Often when museums decide to change or be more political, then there is a reaction against it. And the museum thinks, then the public doesn't want to see this thing. Therefore, we are not going to do it.
Let's talk about what this looks like today. I mean, like museums, I think, at least from what I can tell, like often try very hard, it seems like, to represent artists of color, artists from different backgrounds, from different identities. They seem like they're often trying to grapple with colonialism, especially here in Arizona. Yes. But is that the reality? Like, is that just a small piece of what museums are doing around the country? Like, is diversity still suffering in these institutions?
Well, yes. I mean, the reality is museums normally state that diversity is really important to them.
Right.
But usually, how does that look? It looks in like, let's celebrate Cinco de Mayo, let's do Hispanic Month, let's do performances and whatever. But it doesn't necessarily transform the institution. For institutions to transform in reality, really, really permanently, they need to have diverse staff working in the museum that have knowledge about Latinx art or queer art or African-American artists or feminists or whatever. So the problem is normally that's not the case. You know, diversity, if you look at any statistics today mm-hmm. about participation of diversity in museum, women's participation, you will see how that looks. Does not look good.
That's interesting.
It really doesn't. Yeah. There was a very specific moment during the Floyd marches during the pandemic where mm-hmm. museum had no choice but somehow to participate because there was an enormous amount of criticism online and on the press about how museum were not really defending the rights, the human rights of Black and brown people.
So, I mean, this gets to the heart of like the role of museums in society, right? Like there's yes. there's a very obvious argument about representation, right? Like about who you put on the walls, what kinds of art you're showing, right? In the sense that, you know, yes. it'll help people follow in their footsteps. It's representation is important, but it sounds like you're going beyond that here to talk about the importance of what these institutions mean in our society, the power they hold.
Museums are very important. It pulls about people's trust of the museum. Museums are much higher than even political institutions or other type of institutions. People think that museums are places that actually provide information that is good for society, that is trustworthy, that, you know, the values that you see. But what happens if you are an African-American person in the museum in your community only exhibits art that is not representing the history and the culture that you actually pertain. So that's why in the end, a lot of people feel alienated by museums because they say, well, I'm a woman and there is no exhibition, so there are not enough women in this show. But I do, you know, even though I'm critical of, I think, the slowness of institutions in changing in a more permanent way, which again, I repeat, it needs to happen by including the voices. For the community to be included, you need to have people that are knowledgeable. And there are knowledgeable people, Native American, African American, at very high level, everywhere in society that studied. So they just need the opportunity to be part of this. Mm. But there is change. There is diversity being represented in museum. I think it just needs to continue to increase.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly what you make of what's happening in these institutions here in Arizona. I know you're relatively new to the Valley.
Yes.
What does it look like in Arizona museums to you?
I think it's positive. You know, for example, if you look at the Phoenix Art Museum, mm-hmm. they're actually doing a diverse programming in the institution. Then, of course, you have the Hurt Museum, which is a museum of Native American art. You have the ASU Art Museum, which has a Latina, and, you know, they have curators and they have diversity very much at the center. Or Scottsdale Smoka is also, they do, and they have a diverse staff. You know, they have Tucson Moca also is an interesting institution led by a Latinx person. Mm-hmm. And Tempe too. There is an integration of these sort of more diverse kind of conversations in society. I found because I lived in California for many years, California, strangely enough, is less diverse. And California seems to be a more liberal, you know, place. It's really a wonderful thing that in Arizona there is this intent of representing, well, we want to call it identity politics, but identity politics is embedded in the very notion of diversity.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there then on a hopeful note. That is Dr. Cecilia Fajardo-Hill, Program Director and Associate Professor at ASU's School of Art. Thank you so much, Cecilia, for coming on and talking to us about this course. It's really interesting.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Remember, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show.
Where all the cool kids are, Mark.
That is where all the cool kids are. You're on Instagram, right?
I try.
So that's where the cool kids are. Lauren's there.
You know it.
I know it. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.